is top of the hour in New York City, 82 degrees. August 2nd. Can you believe? Such an odd summer. Well, it started off with an odd springtime. And, I mean, my philosophy is that once the 4th of July happens, like, the summer is just gone, man. But now that August has arrived, it makes you think, okay, what didn't I do so far this summer? I got to get to the beach more. I got to go hiking. I got to do all these different things I've been prolonging and or not able to do because the weather hasn't been that great. My name is Mark Farrell. Welcome to Insight on the Progressive Radio Network. Got a good show coming your way. You think I'm going to say I have a bad show coming your way? No, I wouldn't do that. We got an author on the show in a few minutes. The author of the book White Kids, Growing Up with Privilege in Racially Divided America by Margaret Hagerman. Very, very compelling book. Here. On Facebook, Facebook Live. Go to Facebook page and type in Progressive Radio Network. They can watch this incredible program on your screen, whatever screen you listen to or watch. So summertime, yeah, it's crazy, right? The summer is just slipping away. It's unfathomable how fast time flies. Next thing you know, Labor Day is going to be here. It's going to be like Monday and Labor Day, no matter where you live, right? It usually always is like cloudy, overcast. Next thing you know, on Monday around midday, the sun comes out just in time for everyone to kind of go back from their vacation plans, etc. But hopefully you get some good times in between now and then. We certainly have a lot of great guests planned for the next 4 weeks, 4 or 5 weeks. Josh last week was amazing. He was unbelievable. Max as well. Max was incredible, getting a lot of feedback. And if you'd love to email me, any feedback or questions or guest ideas, love to hear your input. Mark@MarkFarrellMotivation.com. Mark@MarkFarrellMotivation.com. There was a great article the other day in the New York Times called For Sale, Survey Data on Millions of High School Students. So essentially what happened was high school kids across America, when they take the SAT test or any standardized test, there is a questionnaire. And I'm not sure if it goes into detail whether it says it's voluntary, but a lot of kids take it. So what they're doing is offering up all this personal data and companies sell it. So obviously data mining is something you've read about or heard about it. Maybe you know a little bit about it. Maybe you know a lot about it. But it's something that's just, you know, it's inescapable because, first of all, for example, if you go on Google today and put in the word Varidesk, you know, those stand-up desk. Next thing you know, when you go to your Facebook feed, you're going to see Varidesk in there. And if you go to another platform, you'll see that again. So whatever you're shopping for, if it's a surprise for your significant other, child or whatever, make sure you do it covertly. Otherwise, they're going to be like, oh, wow, they're shopping for my XYZ gift or whatever. But it's very interesting because they got data from all this data college questionnaire. And what happened was they sold it to a company called the Congress of Future Science and Technology Leaders, and they're located in Lowell, Massachusetts. And what they did was, I mean, it's kind of brilliant. It's extremely data-driven, targeted marketing in terms of data mining. And they invited thousands of kids to partake in this week-long kind of tech fest that cost almost $1,000 a piece. So just by probably the results of this test and or the questionnaire, they're able to hone in and target these specific students and their parents. And they were just an easy, easy target. So now studies will have, because this was found out, determined. And so now they're going to have an option to opt out. You don't have to take the questionnaire. So the data mining companies will have to do a little bit more mining for their data instead of making it very black and white for them to get their information. So, I mean, it's really taking advantage of our youth and their inexperience, certainly in their divulging info, because, you know, a lot of kids just take it for what it's worth, face value, and not understanding the value of our personal information, because I was reading something a couple months ago. It made me reflect on this as well, because when we think about like Facebook and all these other platforms being free, now they should actually be paying us as a user. Sounds kind of odd, right? Counterintuitive. But every time we put in a keystroke, every time we're looking at a yoga class, every time we're looking at something in Amazon, every stroke, every page you look at, you're being tracked and mapped. And all that data is being mined. So you are, and I am as well, you are giving companies a diary of your life, your personal habits, your shopping habits, your likes, your dislikes, so they can cater marketing, branding, et cetera, to everything that you have been doing or will be doing. As a matter of fact, you'll be, you know, obviously prompted to maybe shop a certain way because they see your habits, and maybe it's they can track it, whether it's during your pay period that you get paid. And maybe they're going to hit you up with sale items that day, knowing that you particularly shop at the end of the month. Maybe you get paid biweekly or once a month. Most people are biweekly, but maybe that would be the case. So it's very interesting to consider that possibly down the road that some companies would actually offer payment. And as a matter of fact, I think there's a test group going on somewhere. I read this somewhere. The article actually I'm referring to was in the New York Times on July 29th. Again, the title is called For Sale, Survey Data on Millions of High School Students. So it went on to go say that companies should compensate consumers for their personal information. Because in reality, we are usually companies before the internet got really big would have research group, focus groups. And this happens a lot in radio where it's kind of a different platform, but you put 20 people in the room and you play them song hooks. This hook of a song is like the most popular part of a song that kind of hooks you in, that makes you feel like, oh my God, I love the song, or I don't like the song. So they play hooks and people rate it on a scale. And that's how kind of playlists are formed, because out of maybe 500 songs, they whittle it down to like maybe 320 or 298, whatever the case may be. But that is an example of what people like. iTunes, all that information that is used when you're selecting a song, all those songs that you download are being, you know, sold. Retailers online are making boatloads of money because of this. So when you really start thinking about like the concentric circles, the ripple effects of our habits online, then it kind of makes sense. Like, wow, yeah, I should be getting paid for this, because it's like I'm almost taking an online survey like these high school kids were, that kind of got, I can't say they got suckered into taking this class, because obviously it was an option to pay $1,000 to go to Lowell, Massachusetts, and to take this class, or to take this tech fest, part in this tech fest. And they did. Most of the kids did. And so, but they got that very small captive audience group. And I find it fascinating when you think of the metrics involved of how they obviously honed in on this particular group of kids who are certainly college bound, very likely to succeed in life, get a higher education, or go into a tech field. And tech fields obviously prosper very, very well. So when you think about, you know, all these ads that are popping up, like my pool heater broke about 2 months ago. So I was searching for a new pool heater. I mean, and so for like I don't know, 4 or 5 weeks after I purchased one, I was still hounded. I'm like, no, not any more information about pool heaters, because I bought one. It's almost like you wish you could opt out. Okay, I bought one. Or they're actually on Facebook. Is there an option to click on an ad that says, why am I seeing this? And you can click out of it, opt out of it. And mostly it's effective. Sometimes it doesn't. I don't know whether it's the algorithm. It's kind of like they make you feel like you're actually partaking in what you're seeing, but in actuality, they're not. And by the way, Facebook has been caught with trolls again in the last 2 days. for midterm elections. And also, there was something else they got caught. They found a troll on Facebook, and I forget what they were doing, what angle of trolling they were looking for. Anyway, so there's obviously needs to be a lot of focus in that area. So a few months ago, I had some great folks on the show from Helen Keller Services. Obviously, they provide services for the visually impaired, blind, hearing impaired, and deaf. And I had them on the show, Russell Morello and one of his colleagues and a student, and they were just phenomenal. And that led to me being invited to one of their larger campuses in the Bronx, and I spoke to some really, really impressive kids and was just really fueled by their motivation, despite their challenges in life, being visually impaired and or hearing impaired and or deaf. And they were just great kids. And I was just really kind of awestruck. And of course, you know, we all know people who are highly motivated. But when you get additional challenges in life, like blindness, hearing impairment, visually impaired, whatever the case may be, bipolar disorder, amputee above the knee, like our guest last week, Max, they're just people who really know how to deal with challenges, adversity, because they are very persistent. They know how to deal with ordeals better than someone who's ill-equipped. Hey, it's great to have a life where you're not actually bogged down with troubles, health issues, etc., challenges. But when you do have something like that, like a disability, it makes you're better prepared in life for challenges and adverse conditions because that's what you face on a daily basis. Anyway, so when I went there and spoke, I was just very, very impressed with the Helen Keller Services, the students there. And so long story short, I spoke to them about 3 or 4 weeks ago because they're having a huge 125th anniversary of Helen Keller Services, which is amazing. A huge event, a gargantuan ticket event. Maybe I shouldn't say that. Well, the good news is I don't have to pay because I'm the MC. They asked me to MC it, so I'm very, very proud to be aligned with such a phenomenal organization, being visually impaired myself, and giving back to an organization that is so selfless. I think about Helen Keller, and I mean this magnificent woman who just defined the word boundless, you know, and determination. Wow. I mean, especially back then, what was available? Assistive technology. What? What the heck is that? No such thing. I mean, I'm 51 years old. My assistive technology was a large print dictionary, which I use as a prop on my talks. As a matter of fact, when I fly out, I got to go to, where am I going? Louisville, Kentucky in September. I take that on a plane. People are like, whoa, what is that? Is that new reading material from the airline? No, it's a 13.5-pound large print dictionary from the New Jersey Commission for the Blind and Visually Impaired. Anyway, so it's going to be a phenomenal event. It's happening, I think it's September 13th in Brooklyn at a phenomenal venue. It's really, really swank. So I'm very, very, so I'll keep you posted about that. I think it's on my website, markfarrellmotivation.com, markfarrellmotivation.com. It's on my Facebook page, Mark Farrell Motivation, on my Facebook page, Mark, the press release and information and the kind folks and what they've put together. So interesting story about what took place today as a lead-in to my first guest today, who is the author of White Kids, Growing Up with Privilege in a Racially Divided America. And man, have we never been so racially divided than right now. Margaret Hagerman has done a phenomenal job dedicating more than 2 years of her life in research and divulging some really scary facts. And I want to start off the show by welcoming Margaret Hagerman to this show with a great piece of work and research. Hello, Margaret. How are you?
Hey, Mark. How are you?
Very good. Where are you based right now?
I am in Starkville, Mississippi.
Oh, nice, nice. I've never been.
Well, you should come check it out.
I would love to, because we have a lot to talk about. So, Margaret, the first thing I want to say is great job. And then secondly, a very ironic thing happened this morning. So I bus into New York City, and I had the seat next to me open, and then the seat to my left across the aisle open. And just concurrently at the same time, someone asked me if they can slip in. I said, sir, sure, of course. And then both people sat down and they were African-American. And here I have, sitting on my lap, is your book, White Kids. So my initial reaction was to what, Margaret?
I don't know.
Turn it over. Right? Because here
so
I am.
So wouldn't see the title, you mean?
Yes, yes. So I did not. I purposely kept it wide open with the title out because I wanted to see if they would take note of what I was reading. And maybe I'm actually literally taking notes. So why was I taking notes of this book called White Kids, Etc.? Anyway, it's a phenomenal book, but I just thought that was an interesting thing that happened. It's almost like a little sociological experiment within
right.
the sociological experiment that you did of 36 boys, white boys and girls, ages 10 to 13, and basically how kids learn about race. So what prompted this?
Well, thank you for taking the time to read the book. I am really excited about it, and it's fun to hear sort of people's reactions to it. I started this project when I was in graduate school, and I'd been doing a lot of reading and research on the topic of racial socialization. So, you know, how parents convey messages about race to their children. And what's interesting is that most of the research on this topic has to do with black families and how parents are preparing their black children to live in a racist society and sort of giving them strategies for navigating the world, et cetera. And so I started thinking a little bit about that great research and thinking about, well, I wonder how, you know, white kids are learning about racism in their families. There's a lot of research about adults and, you know, white racial attitudes of adults, but we don't know a lot about how those ideas form in childhood. So that was sort of what got me started on this project.
It's pretty fascinating because in a time where in 2018, or actually 2017, and I don't think I'm not Pollyanna-ish at all. I'm a realist. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure this kind of made your head spin that when Trump got into office, that it was like full-blown what you think, what you feel about race was just flown up the flagpole. And it's never been more apparent, whether it's always been just below the surface, mm-hmm. but how many people are much more racist than I ever realized before.
Yeah. And, you know, when I conducted this research, obviously President Obama was in office, and what I found was that some of the parents I spoke with, like, they genuinely believed that racism was not that big of a problem anymore. You know, they told me that, you know, if racism still existed, it was definitely not a problem in their community, you know, in their affluent, white, progressive community.
Yeah.
But actually, you know, it's a problem in the South. It's a problem with the few backwards individuals, that
sure.
kind of thing. And I think you're right. I think when President Trump won the election, despite his explicitly racist rhetoric, you know, I imagine some of the parents in my study were shocked, just like you were kind of talking about. And I think that many whites across the country were, you know, like, wow, I didn't realize, you know, I didn't realize that there were, you know, this level of racism still existed. And so I think that this sort of shock experienced by affluent, particularly, I think, liberal white people, and also their realization that, like, other white, affluent, educated people in their own communities voted for Trump. I think that's another thing that's sort of slowly coming out. I think that that's led to, you know, a new recognition by white people of something, honestly, that, you know, members of racially marginalized groups have been expressing for centuries, right?
Mm.
But I think that there's sort of this new sort of recognition, even if it's a vocal minority of people that are, you know, sort of making these really explicitly
sure.
racist comments.
Sure.
Yeah.
Even when you think about the Confederate flag controversy in the last
right.
you know, 3 to 4 years, I mean, it's pretty national, unfortunately, more so in the South. But
right.
Anyway, getting back to the thrust of your book, how did
yeah.
you decide to hone in on the age group of 10 to 13? Did you think maybe their perceptions and ideas were not solidified by then?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the things that I've tried to do a good job of is read across different disciplines. And so I tried to read a lot of child development research. And child development scholars talk about this age range, you know, middle childhood, and really when kids are in middle school is only one easier way to think about it, as a time period where kids are really starting to form ideas about the world beyond themselves. They're having more interactions with other people. They're becoming more independent from their families. And it's a time developmentally where they're starting to sort of form their own ideas about politics and about, you know, in my case, racism. So I think that, yeah, it was a developmentally appropriate time period to look at this. And also, there's just no research on it, or very little research on it. You know, there's some fascinating stuff about, like, three-year-olds and four-year-olds and how they are categorizing people, and more stuff about high school kids. But middle school is sort of an untapped territory in terms of research. So, yeah.
So it essentially comes down to two environmental aspects that kind of shape your perception of racism: school and family.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. And then, you know, the other decisions that family, that parents really make for their kids. So what kinds of friendships they encourage or discourage, and, you know, where they travel, and even the extracurricular activities they participate in. But all of that is sort of, and to some extent, controlled by parents. So I think that family plays a bigger role than we often think about in terms of how kids learn about race.
Margaret, do you have children?
I do not have children, actually.
I didn't think so, because how would you have time to write a book of this caliber? Absolutely.
<Yeah. laughs>
Well, you know, it's funny, because the reason I asked is because my son's pretty outgoing. He's just turned 9 years of age.
Okay.
And we raised him. My wife is Indian. I'm Caucasian. I'm the white, token white guy in the marriage. And, you know, he has friends of different races. We're kind of in, we're in a suburb, and it's fairly homogenous, but, when I grew up in this area, it was usually a third, third, and a third: Caucasian, African American, and the rest. But this is kind of a little outside that belt. Anyway, so when he has friends or has been asked to go over people's houses, we know we always embrace that. And of course, and this doesn't apply to any particular race, but it's in terms of behavior, perceptions, and what takes place. So a lot of times when my son would come home, we would field questions about, you know, maybe race-related practices or habits. So it's as a father and a parent, my wife as well, that it's interesting how you have to be careful about how you couch responses so not to mislead, you know, my son or daughter into a negative thinking pattern or a stereotypical pattern, which is obviously what one of the cruxes of your book is, in terms of letting them have sort of an open canvas, you know, and they can paint their ideas as they experience different things in life. Because besides radio, I speak to audiences on a lot of different topics, often personal experience. And I say, you know, we all judge books by their cover, people, meaning people. And I do too. I'm totally guilty of it. But what I will never do is act on my impulse. I always give people the benefit of the doubt, of my doubt, actually, and treat people with kindness and just a candor, being very honest, and give them the opportunity. Because between the media and, you know, being obviously older in life, we're inundated with the culture and the media's messages of, you know, certain ethnic groups being a certain way. And it's really poison. So there's no real question. There's so many different variables involved.
Right. And I think that parents that are trying to actively raise anti-racist children, which is not all parents, but for parents that are trying to do that, I do think that there are moments where children will come, you know, the kids in my book, for example, come home from school and will articulate these stereotypical views, for example, to their parents. And their parents are horrified. They're like, where did you get that from? You know, and they work to try to, you know, talk about that and why, you know, what they're getting at and what they mean by that. But I think it's a constant process. And I think that there's no easy answer. I think that, you know, kind of like what you're saying, you know, this is an ongoing, you know, parenting dilemma of raising children in a racist society. And, you know, what that means when your kid, in some ways, you know, and your child is multiracial, but, you know, for kids that are, you know, consider themselves 100% white, you know, what does that mean to raise a white kid in a world where, you know, they benefit from the inequality that exists? So I think it's complex.
So besides reading your book, of course, how do you suggest, as a parent, as a person who wants to educate themselves just on being neutral, treating people and understanding, more importantly, understanding how it is for We can't say minorities because most people are, in this classification are not the minorities anymore, not to be racist and or how the other half lives. Because, for example, all the information that you were talking about before, essentially these people are in bubbles because they're very affluent. They, you know, live in certain communities. Maybe they're gated, maybe they're not. And they're, you know, behind, wearing these rose-colored glasses. How do you, besides watching certain news programs, et cetera, how do you get by that and educate yourself so you can open your eyes more?
Sure. So as a sociologist, I obviously think that people should read more sociology. So, you know, part of that education that you're talking about is also, I think, reframing how we understand racism. And I think kind of what we were talking about earlier with Trump, I mean, it's very easy to say that person's racist and that person isn't racist, and I don't want to be one of the racist people. But I think a more helpful way to think about the world is to think about how racism is really, you know, part of the social structure, right? So, like, you know, when we have racial inequality in our housing market, that leads to inequality in our schools, which leads to inequality in the labor market, which contributes to the wealth gap, you know, these kinds of bigger systems. And I think that my advice for people that are trying to work against racism and raise their kids like that is to start paying more attention to those systems. And I think, you know, changing the way you live. I mean, it's not enough just to say I'm not racist. I think a true commitment to anti-racism is to, you know, live the way that you're saying that you want to live. You know, that live in the society that you want to live. Not, you know, not just sort of give it lip service. Sort of this action speak louder than words. You know, and that's what I found in my book, that a lot of the parents were saying really amazing things about how they believe in equity and equality, but then they were kind of giving their children all of these advantages, which sort of undermined those efforts. So I don't think there's an easy prescription here, but I do think that being more thoughtful about what racism is and how it works, and then also thinking about how to change your life and live the life that you're sort of professing, you know, that you want to live.
Well said. Was there any part of the families that you were studying that actually took part in volunteerism, worked or, you know, did anything in different communities that were of color?
Yes, and so there's one chapter in my book where I talk about both volunteering and then also international travel. This is a good example, actually, of parents who, they have really great intentions, right? They want to volunteer at the soup kitchen. They bring their children. They think it's important for their kids to
lead by example, sure.
Exactly. The problem, though, is that for some of these parents, they don't actually talk to their kid about what's happening. So one mother tells me about, for example, her daughter didn't realize that the kids that she was playing with on Wednesday night at the soup kitchen were homeless. She didn't know that until like 2 years into this volunteering thing. And she also, you know, the child noticed early on that all of the kids that were at the soup kitchen were black and she was white, but the parents never talked about that and they never helped her understand what was happening. And so that was, you know, the mom was kind of regretful that she hadn't, you know, talked to her kid about this more. And I think another element is this notion of teaching white children that their job is to save people of color, right? That you're here to save these other kids.
Oh, that, interesting. I never thought of that.
Yeah. And so I think there's a fine line there between, you know, having good intentions, but then ultimately, you know, putting yourself back at the center and being like, I'm going to save the day, you know, which really isn't about, you know, respecting other people and, you know, understanding that people don't need to be saved by you, right?
Sure.
maybe there are other things in our society that need to get organized differently.
Trump will save everybody, so we don't have to worry about that. You don't have to comment. I'll do it for you. So, okay. Margaret Hagerman, to your first point, interesting. Do you think some parents would not maybe mention the fact that, you know, why all the people in a shelter or a food pantry, soup kitchen are black or whatever ethnic background because they would want their child or children to feel that this is just us doing a good deed. It doesn't matter who we're serving.
Right. Exactly. I think that's the sort of sentiment behind it. And I guess I'm just asking parents to be a little bit, in my book, I'm asking the parents to be a little bit more critical
Sure.
about that, you know, and what are you actually teaching them? And then, you know, one of the things that I really love about my research is I get to talk to kids. So it's fun to interview parents, and I like the parents and all, but it's really fun to talk to kids and to sort of spend time with them.
Sure, because they're real.
Yeah, and so you can really see the consequences of different approaches to parenting when you talk to the kids, and you know.
So as an example, I'm sorry to put you on the spot here. I know you're not a parent, but you're a parent and you're working, right? We all are, right? What would you say to a child if you were in that position of taking a child or children to a soup kitchen in terms of being racially neutral or opening their eyes in a proper way?
That's a good question. I think, you know, part of this work has to be, like, constant. So it can't just be, like, you know, sometimes I'll see a lot of articles written about talking to white kids about racism immediately following, like, a racist hate crime, right? So that's fine, but I think that these conversations need to be broader so that then when you're confronted with going to the soup kitchen, you already have, you know, provided your children with a framework to kind of think about what's happening and to talk it through. Another suggestion that I probably have is, you know, there was a family in my study that was involved with, I think it was Big Brothers, Big Sisters, or one of those organizations, and they were mentoring a black child. And they had the kid over to their house, and they spent a lot of time with this child, and they developed real bonds with this child. But then their child never went over to this kid's house, right? Like their child never spent time with this kid's family in their community. And so it wasn't an equal balance, you know? And so I think that I'm not giving any easy answer here, but I think being thoughtful about ways to create more of an equitable relationship between kids is important, so that you're not conveying to your child that, you know, they're there to save the day and the other kid is there to be saved, which to kind of take some of the agency away from that child. So I think preparing the kid in terms of having larger conversations about inequality, and this is not just about race. I mean, we could talk about gender and class and other things.
Absolutely.
And then answering their questions and talking to them honestly. You know, it's funny. So many of the parents asked me after I interviewed the kids, like, what did my kids say, which I thought was super interesting. And a lot of them wanted to know if they should change their approach to parenting. You know, they're literally asking me, like, do I need to intervene? Do I need to change things? You know, so I do think that parents, particularly those that are trying to raise thoughtful anti-racist children, are experiencing a lot of anxiety about this question. You know, like, am I doing it right?
Were the parents given the questions that their children were going to be asked?
No, I didn't give them exactly the questions. I answered any questions that they had about the project. But, and you know, I do sort of a unstructured interview format where I let the kids sort of take charge of the conversation. So I obviously have certain questions I want to ask them, but I certainly don't ask every single kid exactly the same. You know, it's not like a survey in that sense.
Absolutely. I remember being in college. I think it was probably my junior year, and my best friend was African American, Harry. And then I became friends with, I think they were our mutual friends. Anyway, the following year, we had shared an apartment. So I lived with three other African-American college buddies of mine. And I remember one guy who I was, you know, fairly kind of close with, you know, probably a drinking buddy, said to me, so you live with X, X, and X? I'm like, yeah. And he said to me, why? And I'll never forget that, because for the first time, and maybe people thought that, and they were very well-liked guys, and it doesn't matter if they're well-liked, they were just good guys. And I was like, whoa, yeah. So people must think about that. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I thought of it fleetingly, but it never bothered me. And we would make jokes about it. I'm like, I'm the minority. This is awesome. You know, flip the circumstances. Mm-hmm. But it's amazing. Obviously, it's very real. And I think it's easier for someone like myself, for you, or for the people that you interviewed, to realize the lack of, or the eye-opening experience for the last year or so that our country is experiencing, and whether it was just below the surface before and people kept a lid on it, and this floodgates are just totally open now. But I mean, so your book couldn't be better timed, that's for sure.
Well, thanks. I obviously did not plan for this, but
So white kids, I'm speaking with Margaret Hagerman. By the way, that was the owner of the first house, the house that I purchased three owners ago. So do you have any relatives in Freehold, New Jersey?
No.
Well, I'm living in a Hagerman household. How about that? So the conclusions of this are very fascinating. And I find it very interesting when you see different shows and documentaries on social media, And the articles you were referring to after possibly an incident, how we all rush to have conversations. And so if you can, Margaret Hagerman, can you talk to me a little bit about how maybe an ongoing scenario should be? And again, I'm putting you on the spot, but you don't have to, in terms of, because as a not a parent role model right now, an example of an ongoing scenario that people should have with their kids.
I'm not exactly sure what you mean, like an ongoing...
Yeah, conversation about being neutral and treating people for the content of their character versus their not being racist, essentially, instead of just, you know, putting a patch on things when something happens in the news and you explain things as you referred to before. Having dialogue, you know, fairly constantly so kids have an understanding of, you know, race, inequality, socioeconomic, et cetera, versus just when it needs to be spoken about.
Right. Okay. That's a great question. So I think, you know, I guess I'd probably push back a little bit just on the idea of being neutral. I kind of feel like in this moment, and really any moment, but particularly in this moment, it's not enough to be neutral, I don't think. You know, when you're in the face of oppression, right, being neutral is to go along with the side of the oppressor type of sentiment. So I actually think, you know, I think that the being judged by the content of your character, that's like a really great goal, but we're not there yet. And so to just pretend like we're just going to not see race, we're going to be colorblind, we're going to treat everyone equal and that's it, that doesn't really make sense for kids because they do see race. They live in the world. They see, you know, when they turn on TV and they see that, you know, 90% of the people in the U.S. Senate are white and they see that, you know, lots of NBA players, I don't know how many, are black, they have questions about that. They notice that and they're confused. And so in the families that I studied that didn't talk about race, those children had so many questions about it, and they were very confused, and I think they were ultimately ill-equipped to navigate the world because they just did not have the language to talk about it or the experiences to even recognize racism for the most part. And so, I think that part of it is thinking about how to teach your, you know, and I feel very uncomfortable telling parents how to be parents, right? And I'm certainly not a parenting expert, but I do think that for parents that want to raise anti-racist children or children who are not racist, they have to think about how all of the decisions they're making in their life are teaching their kids lessons. So living in a segregated community, sending your child to a private school that's predominantly white, you know, like not having any real meaningful friendships with people of color, all of these kinds of things, like that's what's communicating ideas to to children. So there are awesome books out there that you can read to your kids. There's ways to frame the conversation about racism and white supremacy and everything else. But I think that what my sociological insights suggest is that, like, there's a bigger issue here, and it's about how we set up our lives. And I would encourage parents to be thoughtful about that.
Yeah, I concur. And I also would add that, and you put this in your book, that actions speak louder than words on many levels and fronts, but more so in this particular area, because if you're not talking about it, but you send to your kid to a private school, or they don't go out of their bubble of their segregated area, et cetera, and the person who cleans their home or maybe does their landscaping, you know,
exactly,
is of color, et cetera, et cetera. So it perpetuates everything that you kind of just mentioned.
Yeah.
You mentioned something in your book about how private schools, on the heels of what you just mentioned, could be a contributor. Do you think that is a majority?
Well, you know, my favorite thing about my book, I think, I'm still, you know, I reread it. It's like weird to actually
read. That's kind of cool.
But I really do think that there is something interesting about what kids who attend private school, how they think about their position in the world, right? Like, what are the messages that we send kids when we tell them that you're special and you're going to go to the special school because you're really, you know, like, or you're going to go to the school because you're really smart, or those kids at the other school are not smart enough, or their parents don't care about them. That was a lot of the language I heard. I don't believe that, but that was a lot of the language I heard from parents. And I think that, you know, the educational outcomes might be what are on parents' radars, but I think they're not necessarily thinking about all of the other messages they're sending to their children when they siphon them off and send them to a private school. Again, I think school choice is a very complicated process, and I talked to a lot of parents in this study that struggled with it. and not wanting to be hypocritical, you know. But I do have the one thing about the community I studied also is that there was a really wide range of options, like everything from, you know, parochial schools to sort of these like, you know, gifted and talented, progressive school, you know, Montessori. There's a whole range of different options. And so, but I do ultimately think that, you know, taking your kids out of the public school, that takes away the resources that you would otherwise be contributing. So it's something to think about.
Margaret Hagerman is the author of White Kids Growing Up with Privilege in a Racially Divided America. My name is Mark Farrell. The program is Insight on the Progressive Radio Network. It's 40 minutes past the hour. And I want to go back to something you said before, because I thought about this when I was reading the press material and then diving into your book about the question of why are professional basketball players all African-American for the most part? And I kind of was tossing around some ideas. And it kind of is a great example of what you've been discussing and sharing. And I would think that if I were to answer that question today, I would say to my son and daughter that basketball in a lot of urban environments, city atmospheres, and the kids always come to New York City, they love it. And it's a great way to expose them to how diverse our country is, and certainly in a microcosm area, that basketball is very plentiful. There's not a lot of baseball fields in New York City or a lot of areas of that nature. And the dream of making it into the pros is something that they would shoot for. And some people consider that being African-American, your prospects are reduced when you live in a low-income area. I didn't like the last part, actually, because I'm perpetuating it.
Well, you know, I think what you're really getting at is how sports are racialized in all kinds of ways, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, think about something like lacrosse or like rowing.
Oh,
right?
Great,
like,
examples.
In order to do those sports.
Hockey, even hockey.
Right, hockey. Yeah, I live in Mississippi. There's no hockey happening here for,
yeah,
I think, maybe because
of the
weather.
But the cost involved with that.
The cost, right. And just the all of the equipment and everything else. And I think that certainly there are, you know, some black kids who are rowers and mm-hmm. play lacrosse, et cetera. But I think, yeah, and I think that it's about how race is built into all of our social structures, including sports. I think that's really, it sounded to me like that was kind of what you were getting at.
Yeah, exactly. I can't do it justice, and I'm going to try to in the remaining minutes, but I really love some of your verbiage, existing verbiage, that you kind of twist and make people, readers, realize and think about things in a different light. Like, for example, you write that, in other words, race is a political category created by human beings. Mm-hmm. Like, is it necessary, the word race?
Well, you know, the idea of race is something that people came up with. And I think one thing that is often people are confused about is that race is not a biological concept. It's a social concept. Mm. And the lines that we use to demarcate, you know, different races, these are lines that are drawn by human beings, and they were drawn historically, and they continue to be reproduced in ways that relate to political projects. And so in this way, as history has shown us, race is actually a political system. And so where you're located within that system, this is Charles Mills is a great theorist to look at if you want the more academic side of this. But, you know, where you're located within that system or how you're categorized, that shapes all kinds of things about where you live, who you marry, how you see the world, both, you know, in the past, of course, but also in the present. So, yeah, I think that race is it's not necessary, but the fact is that it's here and it's not clearly going anywhere. And so even though it's a social construction, it's real in its consequences. And to ignore it is, I think, to be misguided.
Talk to me quickly about your upbringing. What kind of environment was it? Was it homogenous? Was it diverse?
My environment was very much like the one I studied. So it was pretty homogenous. It was a suburban community in Massachusetts. I went to public school, but they were very well resourced. You know, the tax base in that local area was supported it, you know. So I grew up in a very, I would say, privileged environment myself.
And was there a dialogue with from your parents about real world diversity or lack of?
Yeah, I mean, I thought a lot about that. I think that we did talk a lot about things. I also had a lot of experiences, though. I was an athlete, and I had a lot of experiences that I think shaped how I think about the world and how I thought about the world when I was younger. And I've had some really amazing professors and, you know, experiences working with kids. I've done a lot of work with kids coaching and volunteering and things like that. And yeah, so I don't know. It's interesting to think about my own racial socialization,
sure.
You know?
Sure. Well, it's interesting actually thinking about your answer. Talking to my son the other day, and I forget what question was posed. And it's kind of cool that they're always dropping me questions, always feeding me questions. And I'm like, never stop asking questions, please.
Yeah.
And between the two of them, like, Dad, can I? And they always preface it, can I ask you a question? I say to them, sure, but you never have to say to me, can I ask you a question? You can just ask me a question.
Just ask it.
Exactly. But anyway, it's interesting how, you know, all these different formulas and thought processes get formed. However, right, wrong, indifferent, et cetera. And then they become adults. Obviously, they're contributing members of society. They're in the workplace. And then they bring those preconceived notions into the workplace. And then there, of course, lies a whole nother gamut of reality, how the inappropriateness or lack of equality in the workplace happens. I mean, it just seems like it just snowballs from high school onward.
Yeah.
And it seems that, you know, we have to, as a nation, you know, keep doing our due diligence to make it more, to have the education out there, because it seems that by, you know, obviously there are a lot of thoughts and theories and examples in college. And that's one of the best things about college, because it's radical and you can think different things, and it's a great time to explore and to question yourself, question a lot of different things, versus me when I went and worked for Club Med and came back home and said, what am I doing with my life? Because I haven't had a drink in 10 hours. That's another thought. But the reality is it's a great and significant time. But a lot of people don't do that, or they just go through the process of going through college because they need to get to X, Y, and Z.
Right.
I don't know if I have a clear question right now, but I wanted to just share that thought with you, because it seems like as adults, I don't think once we start getting into our 20s and 30s, once we get into that profession that maybe would be more homogenous than a diverse, say, field of the arts, possibly, then things just get perpetuated and don't change.
Right. And I think that's why, you know, I think a lot of the parents in my study find themselves in that situation, you know, the one that you're just describing. And
yes.
So I think that's why my push at the end of the book is to really get people to try to think about what it means to be a good citizen. And, you know, for folks that really want, you know, they really truly want to live in an equitable society, I mean, I think that means, you know, getting out of those bubbles and finding ways to, you know, actually put your actions behind your words, you know, and really think about what it would mean in your community, even in your workplace. I mean, this idea that race doesn't happen in all white spaces is also misguided, right? Like, there's all kinds of dynamics that have to do with race that play out at work, and, you know, the comments people make and the sort of assumptions that are kind of underlying different things. I mean, there's all kinds of work to be done in exclusively white spaces, I think, around race, anti-racism. But I also think that thinking about ways to care about the collective rather than the individual is important.
As a sociologist, what do you think our greatest challenge is? And this is a major question, heavy.
Yeah.
You can sit back and take a big breath. What do you think our major, biggest struggle is in America? Racism, sexism, and you fill in the blank.
Well, as a sociologist, I would say that all of these things are interrelated. And that I think in order, even in my book, you know, I don't really do a good job, and I don't say that I'm trying to, but I don't incorporate gender inequality very much in this book, for example. That would be a critique I could make of my own book. You know, I think that to really understand inequality in any society, but particularly ours right now, we have to look at how these different systems interrelate with one another. And to only look at race is to miss out on the fact that people of different genders experience racism differently, or, you know, that people of different races experience sexism differently. You know, so these things all are interconnected. That would probably be my answer. I do think that oftentimes class gets thought of as being more important than race, and that is something I would push back at and say that I think that we live in a society that's ultimately racist, and it's organized in ways that, you know, you need to be thoughtful about how our society is set up to advantage white people, basically. And so I don't want to say that racism is the most important thing. I think everything's interrelated, but I think often racism is the thing that people want to ignore, and I think that's misguided.
As a sociologist, I'm sure in your undergraduate and graduate degree, you studied other countries as well or learned about maybe some practices. Are there any other countries that you hold up as an example that have racism more in control than America?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, I think oftentimes people look to like Scandinavian countries in terms of all kinds of things.
Interesting.
But then again, the diversity there, that, you know, they don't have the same number of people in their countries. And the levels of diversity, you know, the racial demographics look a lot different. So, I mean, I think the United States is unique in a lot of ways. But, I mean, I was just in England a couple of weeks ago, and I mean, they have all kinds of issues going on over there. You know, I don't know that.
Well, the Queen is black, so there's no problem there. The monarchy's always been African American.
Well, yeah.
Wink, wink.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question. I don't think we have a really, I mean, I don't have a great example of a society that's, or a country that's doing a really great job. I think this is a global problem, white supremacy.
No, absolutely. And our president has made clear that obviously that he seems like he's not very open in that area, and not in so many words. But going back to Obama, you know, I guess maybe I was and had my head in the clouds a little bit during those 8 years, because I just thought, and I know I'm not alone in this, that we were more advanced and more open-minded than reality actually came to prove.
Yeah, and you're definitely not alone. I mean, I think that, again, I talked earlier about the shock that people felt, particularly in like white progressive communities, when Trump was elected. And I think that shock wasn't just about him being elected. It was about all these people that voted for him, right? And what does that mean about our country if people are willing to vote for somebody who makes explicitly racist comments and explicitly sexist comments and, you know, et cetera?
Keep going down the column, sure.
Right. So, you know, what does that say about us if, you know, so I think that shock that you're kind of getting at, I mean, there are sociologists that are sort of studying that right now, and I'm not, you know, necessarily doing that. I am doing a new project right now where I'm talking to kids about the current political moment, which is, you know, I'm still getting that data analyzed right now, but it's super interesting to hear how kids are making sense of all of this. But, you know, it's possible, and this sounds very bizarre, but, you know, maybe one positive byproduct of, you know, Trump's explicitly racist rhetoric and policies, maybe that means that there will be more deliberate conversations happening about racism, and that we can kind of move beyond this quote-unquote colorblind, you know, ignorance, really, that racism is over, or it's fine, we don't have to do anything. You know, maybe this will kind of spur people to action that previously didn't recognize racism.
Yeah, good point.
What it is.
I always feel, and this is in a lot of different areas, and I'll explain that in a second after I give you my example, that I always feel like I have to be, and my wife and I talk about this as well, and she feels the same way, that each of us are the ambassador for Environment X. So I do a lot of work in schools and in populations that have disabilities. Mm-hmm. I have a visual impairment. It's not abundantly apparent. It's what they call an invisible disability, because I can walk around and don't bump into walls, et cetera. Sometimes, only after a few cocktails. So, but I always feel that I have to be the person who obviously brings change, opens people's eyes, et cetera. And the same thing is true for when I leave this building today, when I'm in a city street, I always feel like I do this because this is the way I was raised, that I hold the door open for, and this is a very trivial example, hold the door open for somebody. But for someone of color, I really make sure I go out of my way to be extra polite, because I feel like I'm representing a class that needs to learn and to show others of what other color or ethnic background that I'm interacting with, that, you know what, not everyone's that's white is, you know, racist or mean. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of the parents I spoke to in my book actually talked about the same exact thing. And of course, I think, you know, holding the door for people is great. And I think, you know, I totally hear what you're saying. I do think that, you know, there's a lot of there could be people that are holding the door and then they're voting for, you know, against affirmative action. You know,
sure.
Like I still think that the everyday kind of niceness of living in the world, which is super important, and I'm not saying
but it's very pedestrian,
you know,
as well.
Yeah, so I just think it's important to be mindful of both the everyday interactions type of thing, but then also the broader policies that are shaping people's lives in really powerful ways.
And it really opens my eyes, Margaret Hagerman, is when I speak at schools in the city. And I go in there and it's, you know, 95%, 98%, whatever percent African-American, and just see the conditions and seeing how kind of deplorable is oftentimes the case. And I go in there and share my life experiences so they can learn from them. And it's sad to see that the conditions and how inequity is certainly the word that comes to mind. Inequality, right. Sorry. Inequity or inequality or both? I'm not sure.
Both. I would say both.
Yeah, both.
Yeah.
Come into play when you go to the suburbs in a suburban area and you just see the challenges, the overt challenges, even just in the education. But education obviously is the concentric circle when you're young, and it just stems from there.
Yeah, and I mean, so another reason that I wrote this book is because I have also had that experience where I see, you know, close up the impact of racism on children, right? That you see, like, when we're talking about racism, when we talk about unequal schools, that's connected to structural racism, right?
Mm.
And so, I feel very passionately about the fact that kids should live in a fair society. Kids should be able to go to a good public school and have the same education as their peers that live in the next town over, right? Like we shouldn't have a society where some of the condition where people have to have umbrellas in their school because the roof is leaking and other kids are, you know, going swimming in their Olympic sized pool. You know, like, these are just like what's going on, you know? How can
Margaret, I'm sorry, we're going to have to leave it there.
All right.
Okay. What is the publisher? Who's the publisher of your book, White Kids?
It's NYU Press, actually.
Which is right around the corner. White Kids, growing up in a privilege. I'm sorry, let me try that again. Growing up with a privilege in a racially divided America. That's Hagerman, Margaret Hagerman. Do you have a website, Margaret?
I do. It's margarethagerman.com.
Excellent. Makes it nice and easy. Thank you so much for your time, Margaret, and for opening a society's eyes to inequality.
Thank you so much, Mark.
All the best to you. My name is Mark Farrell. If you'd like me to speak at your school, college, corporation on overcoming adversity, celebrating differences, mental health, self-entitlement, and more, check out markfarrellmotivation.com, markfarrellmotivation.com, or 201-344-7138. Always grateful to the kind folks here behind the consoles and programming here at Progressive Radio Network. The founder of PRN is next, Gary Noel. My name is Mark Farrell. Have a great day.